The first case on our calendar is 09-971, State of Ohio versus Byron Claiborne. Mr. Adair.
Chief Justice Moyer, and if it pleases the court, I believe the determination in this case will rest on this case's, this court's determination of the four cases argued on November 4th concerning the constitutionality of Senate Bill 10 version of Chapter 92050 concerning Ohio sex offender registration laws, which I'm hoping the court didn't decide this morning at 9 o'clock.
Can you either pull the microphone towards you or speak a little louder?
Is that better? The problem in this case is that Mr. Claiborne was represented in the Common Pleas Court by one of our staff attorneys on charges relating to the time period before the effective date of Senate Bill 10, but was sentenced subject to Senate Bill 10's tier classification system. Our attorney entered an objection at the time of sentencing, but she didn't walk the file upstairs to the appeals unit until more than the 30 days for filing a notice of appeal had elapsed. We filed a notice of appeal maintaining it was timely because the judgment entry from the Common Pleas Court did not include instructions to the clerk of court from the judge to make service on the parties. If this court decides that Chapter 2950 remains civil in nature, then we would maintain our notice of appeal was timely because there were no instructions to the clerk in accordance with Civil Rule 58. Consequently, Appellate Rule 4A has a savings rule.
Is that customarily done that a clerk would send notice of a sexual classification?
No, not in our county. The standard
is it done anywhere in Ohio that you're
I really don't know about other counties. I would doubt it. The judgment entries in our court are prepared off a template.
I mean, the history of sexual classification, sexual predator or habitual offender in the past have always been classified by the courts as civil, but haven't always the appeals been conducted under the criminal case number?
Yeah, well, that's a case number matter as opposed to the nature of the underlying
proceeding.
Issue. I mean, I relied on a Franklin County case, State versus Furlong, which drew that distinction between the civil aspect of proceedings and the criminal aspect of proceedings and allowed an appeal on the, under former law, sexual predator determination.
Has any appellate court ruled that this can be done or this has been done?
Well, State versus Furlong, we would say, applies to the same distinction between civil aspect and criminal aspect.
But in terms of having a clerk notify a party of a civil action, it's not done anywhere and no court's ruled on
I'm
that.
I'm not aware of it being done any place. I'm not aware of any rulings other than Furlong drawing the distinction we're asking the court to make here.
So other than the distinction of having the clerk notify a party of a judgment, is there any issue in Claiborne that we're hearing this morning that is not covered in Bodike?
My assignments of error in the Court of Appeals weren't exactly the same. There was one involving a residency restriction. The brief I wrote tried to mimic claims other people were making at the time I filed my brief. They're pretty close to what's in Bodike. Bodike would be determinative. When I filed these since, I just have used the propositions of law in Bodike as a guide. So, but it's very much the same and in all essential parts. Ex post facto, retroactive law,
right.
Due process, and then the like. It's all the same.
Yes. Thank you.
Counsel, you are squarely, though, presenting the issue of whether this remains a civil matter or if the changes have transformed it into a scheme that is criminal in nature, correct?
Our position would be that if the court now declares the Chapter 2950 is criminal in nature, which is our fundamental position in these assignments of error we advanced that were not reached, then we would be able to pursue a delayed appeal. Or the proposition of law I advanced is basically a transition rule saying up until now we've always held these matters are civil, therefore for the limited class of people like Mr. Claiborne who were passing through the courts now, you can rely on the former civil classification and you would still have a timely notice of appeal if there were no instructions to the clerk in the judgment entry. So
counsel,
we simply think we should get in court one way or the other.
Counsel, there's actually another option here as well. it seems to me, and that is that it's a civil matter, that notification given in a criminal proceeding, so that it's still a criminal proceeding, even though it deals with some civil issues. Sometimes restitution perhaps could fall into that classification, restitution out of a criminal case. What are your thoughts in that regard, that while it was a criminal proceeding, it a civil ancillary to that would still be criminal?
As a matter of maybe common sense and going back to when this court addressed whether post-conviction proceedings, which are under the criminal case number, or civil or criminal, it seems to me it starts out as a criminal case and makes sense to me to treat it as such, even though there may be matters that you might characterize as civil. It's not been a helpful distinction over time to call a post-conviction action civil when, in fact, it's a ancillary part to the underlying criminal thing. But the court or other courts and other courts have gone off on this distinction, and sometimes I think that it's counterproductive, if that answers your question.
So would you still hold, if you followed the line of thought with Justice Cupp, you'd still say that would then be subject to delayed appeal under the criminal side?
Sure, would make things simpler if we just took the fact it's a CR number and a delayed appeal applies to anything carrying a CR number, a criminal number.
That would require substantial change to a lot of cases that the court has put out where we've said it's civil.
I think we're kind of stuck, aren't we? I believe we're kind of stuck with the way things have evolved.
Hoisted on our own petard, as you'd say.
Well, that's sort of what law is about. To a large degree, that these distinctions are important. They have ramifications elsewhere, and you know, it's a principled process, but it has evolved to this direction that we find ourselves sort of making fine distinctions at this point.
Would that require a Gallatus analysis, in your view?
A what analysis?
A Gallatus analysis.
I'm not sure I follow.
Well, we've said that we wouldn't change from existing precedent unless we went through the steps
right.
that we announced in the case in Gallatus, and I just wonder if we would suddenly jump from civil to criminal, whether we should utilize Gallatus in terms of an analysis as to why we're doing it.
I think probably the simplest thing in the current circumstances is to simply follow along whatever decision this court reaches in the November 4th cases and fix our remedy according to that declaration. This is a very small group of people who are going to be affected by this. This is a probably another year or so that these people will be passing through court, and then it'll be pretty much over. The one other issue to address would be my colleague maintains that there's nothing to appeal here at all. But Mr. Claiborne asked to be relieved from his obligations under this new system. They're substantially greater than he had before. The trial court judge indicated he probably would have been classified as a sexually oriented offender. He would have had 10 years of registration under the old system. The judge did not grant that relief. Therefore, we believe that we have an issue that's properly before the appellate courts. And unless there are any additional questions, I would reserve whatever time I have left. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adair. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I think the issue boils down to whether or not there's anything in this judgment that the defendant can appeal regarding Senate Bill 10. And the main point I'm trying to make in my briefing is that the trial court does not impose the Tier 2 classification, does not impose the registration requirements. The statute does that. The trial court notified
him. What is the ability to challenge the statutory application? What venue does the defendant ever use?
The defendant can bring a declaratory judgment action, would be the main way to do that, or go to a court of equity. But a criminal court is not a court of equity. It doesn't have this power to
well,
start
if you
ordering.
Have a if you have a law that's you're charged under a certain law and you want to say that law is unconstitutional, you can't say that within the criminal case. You have to go out and file a separate declaratory judgment action to say that law doesn't apply to you because it's unconstitutional?
Sure, you can. If the statute you're being prosecuted under is unconstitutional, of course you can challenge that and claim that there should be no trial, there shouldn't be anything. The court should dismiss the indictment. But there's nothing like
that
here.
If that statute doesn't apply to you for some reason, you can't do that within the criminal case. You have to do a declaratory judgment if you claim that statute doesn't apply to you?
Well, the problem, there's a difference between challenging a statute you are being prosecuted under and challenging a regulatory scheme that operates outside the criminal case, and that's what we have here. The trial court does not impose the registration requirement. The court's own comments in this case acknowledge that it's automatically done. This court's decision, it's automatically done by the statute. This court's decision in Hayden says the same thing. The duty to register is automatic. The court does not impose it.
But let me ask you a question. Is that part of the punishment of the case, or is this a separate civil remedy?
The registration scheme is civil. It's a remedial scheme, but it operates outside the criminal case.
And so you have to bring the difficulty I'm having is in Woods v. Tell, we said that under the separation of powers, only the judiciary can impose punishment for an offense. Legislature's powerless to do that. So we have to have a judicial officer announce in court what the punishment would be in order to have the separation of powers problem resolved. And that's been universally accepted. How does your analysis interplay with the Woods v. Telb decision?
Well, there's no punishment here because it's a remedial regulatory scheme addressing sex offender registration.
Why then should the court have anything to do with it?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things, in some cases where the court puts the offender on community control, there's a provision in the regulatory scheme that says if you're putting the offender on community control, you give the offender notification. And that's part of the remedial scheme, and I cite Smith versus Doe, which addressed a similar provision in Alaska law. But in this case, when the offender is sent to prison, the statutory scheme provides that the ODRC provides the notification. The court, in giving the defendant notification here, it wasn't required by statute. The court was just being overly cautious in giving that notification. And in any event, it's a notification of what the statute imposes, not what the court imposes. So
what if the court imposed a Tier 3 classification instead of a Tier 2? Could the defendant not appeal an improper classification requiring more stringent registration requirements than what the law would require? And could not that defendant take that to an appellate court and say, judge just got it wrong? You have to straighten this out because some administrative body someplace is going to say I have to do registration for life when I'm by law not bound by that. Why can't that be appealed?
It could be, Your Honor, because
under where? Under what scheme would it be appealed? A declaratory judgment?
My argument addresses basically a standing issue, and standing is two components. One, the appellant has to have a present interest in the subject matter of the litigation, and two, he must be prejudiced by the judgment that he is trying to appeal. In that situation, he is prejudiced because the court is purporting to add and increase his tier classification above what the law allows, number one. Number two, the court's acting outside its authority because the court does not impose Tier 3. The court does not impose Tier 2.
That position seems to bespeak your argument.
No, it doesn't.
If you say there's nothing to appeal here, why can Claiborne not challenge his classification in an appellate court as a Tier 2 offender and say, gee, I should be a Tier 1? And why can't he have an appellate court review that?
Well, if he had a valid claim that he was Tier 1, then
I guess it would be up to the appellate court to determine if he had a valid claim. That's my point. Mm-hmm. And you argued that just a moment ago.
This case went through full merit briefing in the Court of Appeals. There was no claim that he was misclassified by the court. He's Tier 2 under the statutory scheme, and I don't think that's disputed, number one. But number two, the court does not impose it. The statutory scheme does. And so there's nothing to appeal from this judgment.
Doesn't that lead to piecemeal appeals? Now you're requiring all the defendants who are classified, instead of taking care of everything in one appeal, they have to file an appeal in the criminal case, and then they have to file some separate action, getting a civil attorney to file a deck action on the classification. And now you have duplicate work, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, that's that's part of what standing is. Is standing is what you can appeal from now. There's nothing to appeal from now because the trial court in its judgment did not impose the Tier 2 classification, did not impose the registration requirements, but that's what he wants to challenge in the appeal. Those challenges are not properly heard in this appeal because the trial court did not impose them. Okay.
Mr. Taylor, when you keep saying that, doesn't the judgment entry, the sentencing judgment entry, also include the classification?
It does. There's no legal requirement that the court include that.
It's part of the consequences of the crime, and I know you're saying it's automatic, the judge has nothing to do with it. Well, I mean, that's a concern, but I want to go back to your statement about this being a civil scheme. Are you relying on State versus Cook for that position?
State versus Cook, State versus Williams, Smith versus Doe.
We haven't really dealt with this particular statute in terms of whether it's now crossed the line into punishment as opposed to just mere regulation like a license of a, you know, motorist.
Well, Your Honor, I've did full briefing of the constitutional issues in the Court of Appeals, and that brief is in the record. I filed an amicus brief in the Bodite case, if the court wishes to look at that. And I think this court's statements in case after case, Cook, Williams, Ferguson, support the view that this is a civil regulatory scheme. Now, those issues I don't think are really ripe at this point because the trial court dismissed the appeal, and I guess the court would remand for the Court of Appeals to address those. If the court wants to address those, be the first court to address those here, then I would request the opportunity to brief that. And, of course, I don't know how the court's going to rule in Bodike and the related cases.
Counsel, did you say the statute does not require the trial judge to provide the notification to the defendant of the sexual offender registration requirement?
That's correct, Your Honor. When he's being sent to prison, the statutory scheme provides, if the person is being sent to prison, the prison officials do that just before the offender is released. If the offender is going on community control, the judge does it.
Okay, and then this defendant went to prison, is that?
Yes.
All right. The court orally gave him notice anyway at the sentencing hearing, correct?
Yes.
Why is this case judgment not appropriate for a nunk-pro-tunk entry? It happened. The entry doesn't reflect it, make it a nunk-pro-tunk entry. That doesn't extend the appeal time. And assuming you did that, then what kind of a judgment would you have? Would you still maintain that the notification part or the classification part is not appealable? Or would it be appealable with the rest of it?
Well, I really don't think nunk-pro-tunk is appropriate because there's no clerical error in the judgment. The court did notify him. And I think the court was overly cautious in notifying him. But I suppose, is that error? Did the court err in doing that? It wasn't required to do it. I don't know that it's legal error. It's certainly not an error he's complaining about. He's complaining about the constitutionality of these registration requirements imposed not by the court, but by the registration scheme. And this, I think, leads into one of my other points, is that what's the appellate relief to be afforded to the defendant? If we strike the notification, if the court had not said anything about registration requirements, the offender would still be Tier 2. He would still face these registration requirements. Here, the court did say something, but it added nothing to the registration requirements already imposed by law, and the court does not impose them. So what is the appellate relief to be afforded in this case? And there really isn't any.
Counsel, one of the distinctions I see here with the reference to Bodike is that Bodike was already classified, and then he was reclassified. Once the law changed and that's not exactly what we have here, is it? Where there's a reclassification.
No.
The argument is that the crime was committed when the prior classification schedule was in effect, and his sentence took place once the new classification was in place, and he's classified under the new classification.
That's correct.
Okay. So that's different than what we have with Bodike, which is a reclassification question and the applicability of the statute, as opposed to this fellow never have been classified until the Adam Walsh Act classification was in place.
Well, some people might think there's a difference. I think the 11th District has had some separation of powers concerns about the situation where that Bodike involves, where you have an initial classification, sexual oriented offender, and then Adam Walsh Act comes in and makes him a tier three. And they are making a separation of powers argument out of that. Here, you don't have the problem of supposedly vacating a prior
court
determination.
Exactly. So it's really not a Bodike issue.
Well, it's not on all fours with Bodike, that's for sure. But I think my point is that there's no separation of powers problem in the Bodike case either. But in any event, it is different. Whether the court wishes to say it's a material difference, I guess it's up to the court. But I don't think that's a material difference, because there's no separation of powers problem in Bodike either, in my view.
The issue that I think is really front and center for me is, if let's assume that we rule standing against you and find that he has the right to appeal in this case, What is his method of appeal, in your opinion? If we find he has a right to appeal, is it a criminal appeal or is it a civil appeal?
It would be a civil appeal.
And if it is a civil appeal, didn't he not have the right to a copy of the entry to start the running of the date?
It would be a timely appeal if there was some civil component in this judgment that he could appeal. My issue is that the SB 10 things he wishes to appeal are not part of this judgment. Yes.
So
the judge notified.
How does he appeal it? From what does he appeal if it's a civil appeal? What is the triggering point for his appeal, in your opinion?
I'm saying he cannot appeal it at all.
Okay, so your point is it doesn't matter whether it's civil or criminal, he has no right to appeal, period, end of story.
Because the court does not impose it, and what would be the appellate relief? In the Court of Appeals, the defendant...
Now, let's go past what is the appellate relief. I just want to know, what is the procedural process that gets him before a Court of Appeals? And you're basically telling me there is none. In your opinion, there is no civil process to get him in front of a court.
He's appealing from something that did not prejudice his rights as far as his registration duties. The statute.
And the only method, according to you, is that he has to bring a declaratory judgment action challenging the application of the statute to him under whatever theory he thinks is wrong.
Correct.
That he thinks it's wrong.
But what happens if, like the question was asked previously, that the judge erroneously refers to a higher level of classification, a more onerous registration requirement, when he is not the material for that, and he is rightfully responsible to a lesser classification? What happens if that is put in the judgment entry and that's part of his sentencing entry? What does he do then?
Then he has an appeal from that judgment, because that judgment is purporting to place him in a higher tier than the law allows.
So he does have a right to appeal that, but you're saying he doesn't have a right to appeal that he is even in the classification scheme?
Yes, because the statute... The trial court did not purport to say, I'm imposing 25 years of registration on you. All the court said was that there's this law that imposes 25 years on you. The court did not purport to do that. In the situation, the tier three example, where the guy's really tier two, in that situation, the court is purporting to heighten the offender's registration requirements. And so in that situation, the court's action, just as under prior law, when the court found the offender to be a predator, the court is increasing the offender's registration requirements above and beyond what the law otherwise would allow.
And so the appeal is then solely limited to the erroneous classification. Do you agree with that? If there's a he's wrongly classified as one tier as opposed to another, right?
That's what he's prejudiced by, yes.
Okay, so the way that he deals with that is to appeal the classification that the judge has declared through a civil appeal?
It's a civil remedial scheme. The court has purported to classify him and done so erroneously and prejudicially to his interests. Therefore, he would have an appeal from that.
A civil appeal?
Because
he's not appealing the underlying criminal conviction. He's saying the consequences of the conviction, these civil remedial consequences, have prejudiced me, and I need to appeal that in order to correct the record.
Under prior law, the sexual predator appeal was a civil appeal. That would be a civil appeal as well.
So you're departing from the reasoning in the majority here that said this was an appeal from a criminal case.
Well, I think the majority and I are on the same page in the sense that my argument is that there's nothing civil in this judgment to appeal. And that's what the majority said. There was no civil proceeding here because it's imposed by law. The court did not, but if the court had imposed something more than what the statutory scheme allowed, then the offender could claim prejudice.
Mr. Taylor, haven't we done this before when we had habitual offenders and sexual predator classifications? And there were a number of appeals from those to appellate courts, and they reviewed those under a civil standard because they determined that those were civil classifications. Why wouldn't we just use that same model here and permit a defendant to appeal in the criminal case the classification as a Tier 2 offender when he thought he should have been a Tier 1? And then the appellate court can do it as they had done under the earlier classifications, and we avoid all this.
Well, my point's twofold on that, Your Honor. First, obviously, if you were found to be a predator under the prior scheme, the trial court itself was heightening your registration requirements.
Yes.
That predator determination. And so
sure.
There was something in the judgment.
If you were to be an habitual offender and the court classified you as a sexual predator, you could appeal that.
Right. And the court's judgment, which was placing you into a higher classification,
yes,
and you were claiming you were prejudiced by that, you have an appeal from that. And it was a civil appeal because it's a civil issue what classification you have.
But the appeal came in the criminal case, and the appellate courts determined those using the civil standards because it was a civil remedy, as you've indicated when Cook and a number of other cases have addressed that. So if an individual, such as Mr. Claiborne, contends that he should not be classified as a Tier 2 offender, he could appeal that in a criminal case, and an appellate court could look at it and determine if he was properly classified or not, just like they did in the old regimen.
Well, my second point on the prior scheme was that there were several cases under that prior scheme that said, if the law automatically, where offenders tried to appeal sexually oriented offender status, and there were a number of appellate courts, including the 10th District, that's relying on this court's decision in Hayden, which said, and these courts said that you can't appeal that. There's no appeal here because the court didn't do anything to you. That this is imposed as a matter of law by the statutory scheme. And so this is the situation we're in now. The statutory scheme imposes the Tier 2 classification, imposes the 25 years. That's what he's complaining about, and that's what, but the court doesn't impose that. So there's no kernel, a civil nugget in this criminal case that is appealable because the court,
Capsulized,
the court doesn't impose it.
Your position is you want us to extend Hayden and apply it here and say that because the court doesn't impose the classification, it's done legislatively, there is no appeal. Have I got that right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe that's the answer to my question. I test your premise that the court does not impose the sanction of the sentence. If the court does nothing, is the defendant in Tier 2?
If the court had said...
Until the court does something, I guess, is the question. What's the defendant's status?
If the court had said nothing about registration requirements, he would have been tier two.
How would that happen? How would anyone know that he was tier two? What would his requirements be if the court doesn't say anything?
Well,
my point is, it's the court order, is it not, that requires the defendant to do something? It's the statute says, court, you have to do this, but we have other, and maybe Hayden is the answer, but we have other situations in which, like the gun spec, for example, if you're convicted of a certain crime and certain conduct, you get a gun spec added on. Statute says so, but it doesn't, it's not in effect until the court says so, is it?
Well, a gun spec's a criminal sentence, Your Honor. This is not criminal. This is a civil regulatory scheme that operates above and beyond.
Why is the principle not the same? That until the court orders something to happen, to occur, it doesn't happen, does it?
It does under this scheme. The court wasn't required to say anything about tier two. The statutory scheme provides that he's convicted of this offense. It's tier two automatically, just like in what Hayden said. And so,
I guess my question is, what happens if the court, if there's no order saying tier two from the court, what's the requirement of those who have to enforce the tier two registration requirements? Do they just look at the statute and say, well, here's, trial court didn't say it, but statute does, so defendant, you're required to do X. Is that how it would work mechanically?
That's how it would work. ODRC notifies him before he gets out of prison, and there's a notification form, and he slots in as tier two.
Counsel, what would have happened had the court in the entry classified him under the previous classification, the Megan's Law, as opposed to the Adam Walsh Act? Which is what the objection is, that he should have been, because his crime was committed when the Adam Walsh or the Megan's Law was in effect, that's the classification that he should have been subject to, right? I mean, that's the crux of the argument here.
I guess he's conceding that he would have been subject to Megan's Law.
Okay, and if the judge would have put in the order the classification scheme and referenced it that was in effect when he committed his crime, which would have been the provisions of Megan's Law, what remedy would be available to the state at that point?
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure what binding value it would have, because the court does not have the tier two, does not have the issue before it. There's nothing on which the court can say, I'm going to refuse to do this and thereby thwart the statutory scheme. So the question of the constitutionality of the statutory scheme is really not before the court. I suppose the state could appeal, but that's not this case, and so I haven't analyzed that particular hypo. If I could just briefly conclude, it looks like we're way over time. I would just point out the defendant in his demand for relief in the Court of Appeals said the trial court erroneously classified him as tier two. The trial counsel said, we only wanted to object to the finding of tier two. Well, the trial court does not impose tier two. And so they were objecting to something the trial court doesn't even do. And so it's just an appeal. It's just in the opposite here. And so I would ask that the court affirm the judgment
of
the
Court of Appeals. Thank you. Mr. Dare, you've saved 7 minutes of your time.
I probably won't use all of it. In essence, this is a misclassification case. Our assertion is he should have been classified as a sexually oriented offender under Megan's Law. That was the basis for the objections that were brought forth in Bodike and elsewhere. He was misclassified. He should have been classified as a sexually oriented offender. Had he been classified as a sexually oriented offender, I'm sure Mr. Taylor's office would have appealed that.
But in Bodike, it's a reclassification, and you don't have a reclassification here. He committed the crime in 2007. The law changed during the processing of his case, and Adam Walsh Act was in effect when he was sentenced, and that is the scheme under which his requirements for registration and notification proceeded, which is different from the Bodike case.
In the sense that in this case, we do not have a separation of powers issue because the reclassification would have been done by the Attorney General's office. They would have sent out notices.
In the Bodike issue.
Bodike.
Not here.
Right. So we don't have that. We don't have a separation of powers issue here because this is the first time he's been classified.
Right.
But he has been classified. He's been classified as someone subject to the tier system under Adam Walsh instead of the Megan's Law distinction between sexual predators.
But isn't that a declaratory action then to determine what version of the classification applies to your client, not an appeal?
Well, but that was determined by the trial court, which...
How was it determined by the trial court if there was...
They rejected his claim that he was entitled to be treated under the Megan's Law version of these things. In the courtroom, this came up during the plea colloquy, during the criminal Rule 11 aspect of it. You know, the judge wanted to cover that at that point, that you will be classified as a Tier 2 offender. The transcript reflects people reading from the notification form that apparently has to be filled out at that time, so there is some ministerial duty, even in these cases, at that point. But when it was addressed, some action was taken. But again, the basic...
Was it objected to in trial? Yeah.
Yes, it was. Yes.
And, or at the sentencing. It
right,
was objected
yeah.
to and said, no, he should be classified under the Megan's Law version.
Right. Well, it was, you know, one of many things that were being talked about more or less simultaneously, but the objections were entered, the constitutional objections were entered at that point. The judge tacitly rejected them because he included in the judgment entry, whether he had to or not, he did include in the entry that this was a Tier 2 offense that by itself rejects the constitutional claims and makes this ripe for appeal. The judge took that action. In Bodike, the petitioners had received a notice from the Attorney General. They petitioned to be relieved of community notification. Under the former, their offenses would have made them Tier 3 offenders. All Tier 3 offenders under the current scheme maybe are subject to community notification. They wanted to be relieved from that because before they'd not been adjudicated predators, they weren't subject to community notification. And they tacked on to that petition all the constitutional claims, ex post facto, retroactive right. law, so forth and so on. There, they did have the separation of powers, but they had all the other claims like we do here. The statute, 295011, or which I think it is, that provides for petitioning from relief doesn't provide specifically for broad constitutional challenges, but in fact they were entertained and they came to this court and standing was not an issue. We think we're in that same position. We simply want to be able to advance the same constitutional challenges that petitioners in Bodike did, except for the separation of powers.
Thank you, Mr. Adair.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.